For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
We've got a lot of difficult questions ahead. Maybe now is the time to debate difficult issues such as triage.
That was Dr. Eliana Close, a lawyer and postdoctoral research fellow at the Australian Centre for Health Law Research at the Queensland University of Technology. Eliana and a group of colleagues have written an ethics and law paper for the MJA detailing the importance of established triage policies to support clinicians during critical moments of resource allocation in pandemics and other disasters. Dr. Close is my special guest today. Morning, Eliana. We're seeing awful scenes from India where the health system has been overwhelmed by COVID-19. Doctors have been forced into making truly difficult decisions. Things haven't come to that here. But why are Australian clinicians working for more support for their triage decisions? Why is it a bit of a minefield legally?
That's a great question. I think anecdotally, we've heard lots of concerns from clinicians that they might face some kind of legal jeopardy if they were asked to make triage decisions in the context of the pandemic. So this is a situation where we have more COVID cases than we can cope with, the system becomes overwhelmed, and they have to prioritize patients that have an equal clinical need. So we've heard anecdotally and from accounts overseas that clinicians really are worried about being in that position and then facing legal lawsuits afterwards.
There was a time last year when this was on the minds of everybody, wasn't it?
There was, yeah. Right in March of 2020, there was a flurry of activity in this space. We had modeling predicting that our ICUs would be overrun by April of 2020. And so at that time, a lot of different groups started to think about triage protocols and frameworks for how to guide decision-making if the critical care resources were overwhelmed.
When you say a triage policy, what do you mean exactly?
So that's really a broad umbrella term that we use to cover any kind of guidance that's given to clinicians at the bedside who are making resource allocation decisions. So they're making decisions to prioritize who's going to get this ventilator if we only have one left and we have more than one person that needs it. So that can encompass a broad variety of different kinds of guidance. So we've seen things like general guidance documents, broad ethical principles that might say want to maximize the most benefit for the most number of people in this situation. But there's also more specific guidance documents that have been developed, and those are known as triage tools or triage protocols. And those type of documents would give much more precise guidance about who's in, who's out, often assigning scoring systems to people in order to make those allocation decisions.
Every state's pretty much got a disaster management plan. What's the difference between that and what we're talking about?
Responding to something like a pandemic or a natural disaster obviously requires a great deal of coordination across a number of different government agencies, including the health service. And so states have these disaster management plans, which are comprised of legislation and policy aimed at coordinating that response. And for instance, there's emergency legislation that would give the chief health officer powers to issue stay-at-home orders. And there's other guidance about who does what in these type of situations. So a triage tool is really one small cog, small but important cog in that broader disaster management response. And so far, as we've detailed in the article, we haven't seen a lot of triage tools issued by Australian governments, at least purpose-built for this pandemic.
Is it a surprise that the national government hasn't done that?
No, I don't think so. In the COVID guidance from the national government, there's a sort of brief mention that they will issue or help coordinate national triage criteria if required. In terms of constitutional arrangements, it's the states that are responsible for health services. So it's really them that would be coming up with these type of guidance documents.
Let's talk about the legal side of things. Perhaps we should start by talking about what happened in New Orleans in the Hurricane Katrina crisis, because that seems to be one of the more prominent examples that pops up when we talk about the legal implications for doctors in these kinds of situations. What happened there and what does it mean for the broader view?
Sure. So the Hurricane Katrina disaster is interesting because although it wasn't a pandemic, it was a natural disaster. And so we saw stories of health services that were under incredible strain. And one of those stories was a story of a woman named Dr. Poo, who was a cancer surgeon in a health facility that due to the hurricane, had been without power and water for a number of days. And in that time, there were critically ill patients that they were trying to look after, and a number of them died. So in the aftermath, quite shockingly, Dr. Poo and a couple of nurses got charged for their treatment of four elderly patients who they'd administered medications to with what they said was the aim of relieving their suffering. But afterwards, they were charged with homicide. Ultimately, a grand jury refused to indict them, but of course those charges were quite shocking, to say the least, and Dr. Poo in particular faced also civil lawsuits after the fact. So this was made a lot of a stir, both in the media and in medical journals, and I think it illustrates that clinicians do express these worries. They express fear of litigation and liability, and I think it's important not to fearmonger and not to overstate those, but it's also important not to dismiss them out of hand, because charges still are possible in these type of extreme situations.
So what protections do Australian doctors need explicitly in writing from their employers, government agencies, etc.?
The best type of protection would be indemnity laws or immunity laws. And we've seen other countries like the United Kingdom who have actually made legislation that specifically protects clinicians who are making these kind of triage decisions. But absent those, the next sort of best thing for legal protection would be to have triage policies that can help guide decision making. These policies aren't necessarily definitive. Clinicians still would need to act reasonably in the circumstances, but as our article details, they provide an additional level of legal protection.
I'm chatting with Dr. Eliana Close from the Australian Centre for Health Law Research. Her co-authored paper can be found at mja.com.au, where it is free to access. If you would like more reading on this topic, one of Eliana's co-authors, Associate Professor Will Cairns, a palliative care physician, has written an opinion piece for Insight Plus, the MJA's online weekly news magazine. You can find that at insightplus.mja.com.au. It is also free to access. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can find all our episodes at mja.com.au. You can also subscribe to our feed through Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Back to our chat. In your article, you talk about four implications for clinicians. Perhaps you can detail those for me.
We set out some parameters around why triage policies are important, and particularly why triage, specific triage tools are important for clinicians. Mm-hmm. One of the implications of not having a triage policy is that without this kind of protocol, withholding or withdrawing life-sustaining treatment because of a resource shortage is potentially risky, because it may be hard to establish that you've acted in a reasonable way, you've acted according to the standard of care. So one really big plus of having triage protocols and policies is that clinicians can rely on them if they were facing a lawsuit to say that what they did was reasonable. A second implication is that when governments and professional bodies are considering issuing triage policies, it's really important that they rely on appropriate evidence and that they also comply with specific jurisdictional laws. So the relationship between law and policy is kind of a funny one sometimes. Sometimes mm-hmm. the law dictates what we should do and dictates the right thing to do. Other times we have policies or ethical codes that might dictate a result. But it's really critical that when those two things conflict, the law is going to take precedence. So a policy always needs to comply with specific laws. A third implication is that it's just important to have a policy, but it's also important that clinicians don't just blindly adhere to policies when they exist. So these kind of cases are always going to be decided on a case-by-case basis, and clinicians really need to take reasonable actions that are responsible to the circumstances in front of them. Finally, and I think this issue has received somewhat less attention, policies should also be providing guidance for what to do when someone is denied life-sustaining treatment. So not only who gets access to that last ventilator, but what to do when you're saying no to someone, and when you're saying no to someone that would otherwise have benefited or may die as a result. So we need to have guidance for communicating with the patient or their family, also guidance for if there's any appeal mechanisms, which may not be possible given the urgency of decisions, and information about providing appropriate palliative care to that person who will be dying.
Does the state-federal divide, which is just so perennial in health in this country, does that make life harder or easier when trying to get this done?
When it comes to withholding or withdrawing life-sustaining treatment, there is some variation in state laws. So for instance, one real quirk of the law here is that in Queensland, you need consent to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatment from someone who lacks capacity, except in an emergency. So this is a situation where someone might be sedated in the ICU and doctors might say, look, we think this ventilator should be removed. And the family says no. And that is a real problem. It's a real conflict. So any kind of triage policy in Queensland would have to accommodate that local law. This is, I guess, one of the joys and the troubles of a federal system is that we do get that divide. But certainly there do seem attempts to have coordinated responses. And that's where I think some of the professional bodies like the Australian New Zealand Intensive Care Society can come in and provide leadership in this area. So they've issued a guidance framework that's meant to inform local policies. And they've included in that guidance document their sense of what the right principles should be to incorporate into the local policies.
What happened in the UK? There was a challenge, wasn't there?
There was, yes. So the UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence is the UK's body that deals with resource allocation and rationing decisions. And they issued a COVID-19 guideline for critical care resource allocation back in March of last year. So this set out basically who was eligible for hospital admission and referral to critical care. And the original version said that every patient would be assessed on the clinical frailty scale for frailty assessment. So this is a measure to determine how well a person is, how frail they are. And the guidelines said that those people with a CFS score more than 5 would be deprioritized for hospital admission. And the issue with frailty is that, of course, someone's frailty would be reasonably connected to their likely clinical outcome. So there is some case to incorporate a measure of frailty into these assessments. But the problem was that many people with long-term disabilities would be scored at more than 5 simply because they had greater care needs. So a legal action was threatened, arguing that this amounted to unlawful discrimination because it was this blanket exclusion. And they also argued it was a problem that NICE never consulted with disabled people before adopting the guideline. So it actually didn't get to court. They just went through the preliminary procedure, writing a letter. And in response, NICE revised the guideline to reduce the reliance on that scale for some patients and make it more tailored and more appropriate. Kind of a neat illustration of how being transparent about the particular policy led to an improved outcome.
That was my next question. What part does transparency play in this in terms of the way in which it can be accepted by the community?
Transparency, we think, is critical, and that's for legal as well as ethical reasons. It's a real central tenet in public law that decisions are made according to fair processes, which are publicly available for scrutiny. So making triage policies transparent gives notice to both patients and their families and healthcare workers about what processes are going to be followed and what the relevant issues are to be addressed. But as the NICE example illustrates, it also allows open public debate about the content of policies. So we can debate some of these ethical decisions. And they also promote quality and consistency in decision making. So what we've seen elsewhere is that some jurisdictions will take another state's policy and drop it in and copy it. So there's that sort of sense that we can promote consistency across jurisdictions. You know, I think the public debate about this is really important.
And trust seems increasingly to be an issue, doesn't it? Trust does seem to be a really important part of getting communities on board.
Yes, I agree. And it's interesting how trust plays into this issue, I think, because on one hand, we've had people advocating for open, transparent triage policies so that they can be scrutinized. But then on another hand, there's probably some political reluctance to release them because there's this sense that we don't want to fearmonger. We don't want to say, you know, we're going to have to choose between grandma and the neighbor down the street when it comes to who gets the last ICU bed. So it's a real challenging issue, I think.
Given that we never quite got to the critical mass point here last year, I guess it's understandable that the government never came up with these policies. Are they taking a risk now in not doing it while we're in this relatively quiet phase? Because everybody seems to think it's inevitable once the borders open that we'll get another wave. What's the risk the governments are taking at this point?
I mean, I have no doubt that they're aware of the need to have these policies in place. For instance, New South Wales actually has been pretty open. They've got a framework that they developed back when H1N1 was an issue in 2010. And they've developed some COVID guidance based on that. So I know that the governments are aware of this, but I still think there's not a lot of political incentive for them to release the documents in advance, unfortunately. Mm. We've seen this abroad, and I just think that the governments themselves may wait till the last minute to release them. I mean, I would like to see more attention even paid to the potential for legislation that would provide indemnity or immunity. But, you know, I think there are good reasons to release the documents, and we should be talking about them. And so that's why I think we wanted to write this paper to just draw a bit more attention to the issue of triage. We really need to remember how incredibly fortunate we are to have managed the pandemic as well as we have. And that's really been a result of these strategic public health measures, but also we've got the luxury of being this little island bubble. But there will be future pandemics, and our way out of this one is not yet certain. We've got a lot of difficult questions ahead. Maybe now is the time to debate difficult issues such as triage. It was interesting to see what happened here in Queensland. We had a very complex ethical framework that was released. A number of clinicians from the Queensland Clinical Senate had worked very hard on that and had consulted widely. And that was released for several months, but then it was pulled back as the pandemic quieted down later in 2020. And it was unclear why, but there were some media reports a few months ago from the chief health officer saying that, look, she really wanted to give people reassurance that we were on top of things. Having documents like this out there does provide a measure of confidence or certainty to clinicians who are working on the front line. I mean, again, as I said, in New South Wales, it appears that we have these. So I don't want to miss the point that actually these may be in place. Governments may have these and they may just not be made public. Yeah. So I think it's a complex situation.
So wave a magic wand for me, Eliana. What would you like to see happen right now?
I'd like to see more publicized triage tools if they exist. Again, to use that New South Wales example, theirs is based off their 2010 H1N1 policy, but their COVID adaptation of that doesn't appear to be available online. I'd love to see them make that public. From that perspective, I think we should have clear bioethics tables or bioethics committees that are looking at this in each state so that if things ramp up, then we have a clear plan of attack and a clear way to release this again if things ramp up. And of course, from a personal perspective, I would like to see our borders opening up. I'm Canadian, as you can probably hear. And, you know, it is hard to be in this fortress Australia after all this time. I'll be interested to see what happens as we move forward.
Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.